Journalist and author Wendy Williams has had a lifelong love affair with horses and has focused her new book on the unique and centuries-old relationship between man and horse. Cincinnati Zoo director Thane Maynard had the opportunity to speak with Wendy Williams about her book, The Horse, The Epic History of Our Noble Companion.
Wendy Williams, thanks for joining us.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well, and I'm excited about your book, simply called Simply called The Horse, An Epic History of Our Noble Companion. It really was a great overview, because as the subtitle explains, you really get into the evolution of this species that, you know, so many people are familiar with, whether it's domestic horses or even wild horses. Certainly everybody listening knows what a horse looks like. But in the book, you talk about it. So tell a bit about the role that the ocean played in the horse evolution.
Oh, that's really interesting. First, I think it's more about, to me, it's about the evolution of the partnership between horses and humans, that we actually, our earliest known ancestors, direct ancestors, appeared in Wyoming in the same place and at the same time as the earliest known ancestors of horses today. So it's sort of like we were partners from the very beginning, and we moved through time through all kinds of experiences and became the modern human and the modern horse. And one of the elements in that story is the ocean and how the ocean affected the energy systems of the Earth over 56 million years. I found that very fascinating because I live on Cape Cod, where, of course, the ocean is very important to us in our daily lives. It really puts things in perspective when you think about the fact that the Atlantic Ocean hasn't always existed. At one time, all the continents were pushed together, and we had a particular kind of climate. And then as North America and South America began to separate from Africa and Europe, and I guess to some extent Asia, the Atlantic Ocean opened up, and that changed everything.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Now, you also explore how horses ended up looking the way they do. So how does a horse, why does it have a hoof?
You know, that's really interesting. When I was five, I'm 65 now, so when I was five, I was given a book as a young girl about the evolution of horses, and it said that horses began as small animals the size of the dog, and that it had basically what amounts to paws. Mm-hmm. It had a pad and four toes on the front feet, three toes on the back, by the way, even then. They didn't have any nails. They had tiny little proto-hoofs at the end of each toe. But they lived in a very warm, wet climate of Wyoming then, instead of being the way it is now, dry and hot and desiccated and very difficult weather-wise, was then pretty much the same year-round, and it was wet and it was hot, and there was a lot of lush greenery, including a lot of fruit. So the earliest dawn horses enjoyed eating fruit, and they enjoyed wandering around in what basically amounts to marshland or a sort of a jungle-like area where they could eat leaves. They didn't eat much grass because there wasn't much grass, and if there had been much grass, they wouldn't have been able to eat it because they had the wrong kind of teeth. But as the world got drier and colder, the lushness disappeared, and eventually, by about 20 million years ago, grasslands spread all around the world, and horses were so well poised to take advantage of that.
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing. So you mentioned the relationship of humans and horses, but when were horses domesticated from wild animals?
You know, we don't really know that. The answer to that question, like so much of what I looked at, is really lost in the mists of time. It was very frustrating to me because I wanted to know definite things, and there isn't a definite answer to that. The closest way we have to answering that is to look at a site called Botai in Central Asia that goes back to roughly 5,500 years ago. And we know that 5,500 years ago, the people who lived in Central Asia on this extensive dry plain with grass built themselves little villages, and they had paddocks in which they kept horses. And we know this is true because researchers have found the post holes from the paddocks, and inside the paddocks they have found shards, bits of pottery, that from pottery that had cracked apart and stayed there over time. And recently those shards of pottery were investigated, and they found horse protein residue on the inside, showing that the people were actually milking the horses and living on the milk. So that's 5,500 years ago, and that's the earliest widely accepted evidence of domestication. But, of course, domestication and riding aren't the same thing. Maybe they were riding those horses and maybe they weren't. We don't know. There's no evidence that they were. There's no bits and bridles. There are things mm-hmm. that some people suggest maybe bits and maybe bridles, but no one agrees on that. And, of course, it's not really necessary to have a bit or a bridle to ride a horse. It's convenient for sure, mm-hmm. but it's not necessary. So did riding start earlier? Did riding use tack, accoutrement, to help the riders that just didn't last over time, that was perhaps made out of reindeer antler, which is harder even than wood, but does eventually disintegrate? We don't know.
Yeah. You know, now you mentioned earlier that horses had an early start here in North America, but then later, at the end of the Pleistocene, they went extinct.
So in North America, yes, they
right,
did.
Right, right. But obviously that didn't happen elsewhere in the world. Tell a bit about that.
Well, in fact, it did happen in most of the world. Horses were and remain a tremendously resilient group of animals. They weathered hot weather. They weathered cold weather. They weathered mountains rising and falling, asteroids causing havoc, volcanoes causing havoc. But ultimately, at the end of Ice Age, horses became extinct all over North America, where they had evolved mm-hmm. for 56 million years, throughout South America and throughout much of Europe and Asia. But there were a few remaining pockets of ponies in Asia and Europe. No one is quite sure where those small pockets of ponies survived. They had to have survived because we have them here with us today. One place where it's possible they survived is the northwestern corner of Spain, in a place called Galicia. So I went there to visit several scientists who have studied the wild horses of Galicia called the Garanos. Mm-hmm. They are a very basic horse that has run free for thousands of years in the mountains of Galicia. Nobody knows how long. It's one of those archaeological questions when you ask how long has this been going on. People tell you as long as anyone can mm-hmm. remember. But those ponies may be the horses that survived. Of course, they may not be, but there is a lot of evidence that said that they may well be. And then there also appeared to be some horses who survived in Central Asia, in that part of the world where they were able to adapt to the changing climates. But mostly when the climates changed dramatically, the horses just could not cope with that kind of dramatic ecosystem change.
Absolutely. It's a fascinating history. It really is. I've been fortunate to see the Przewalski's horses running wild in Mongolia that were reintroduced from captivity.
Yes. I went there as well.
Yeah, that's something. And, of course, the Mongolians and their relationship with their horses, I've never seen anything like it. They don't have a paddock. They live right there with them. It's wild.
Right. I think that's the traditional way of keeping horses, how Mongolians keep horses. Until we invented barbed wire, we really didn't keep horses in fields.
That's right.
Because it was too difficult and too complicated. If you were a wealthy person and could afford to hire people to go out and bring you hay, then that's what you did. But if you were not a wealthy person, you couldn't, and it was, you were on your own, but horses had to go out and forage for themselves because you couldn't afford to bring the hay to mm-hmm. them. So all over the world, you will find these populations of horses that now roam free, that people take care of and look after. Just like our horses in the West, the populations of horses that do well are the populations of horses that have local people who look after them and care about them. Mm-hmm. And that's true even down in Botswana. There's a population of horses that runs free in the desert, Namibia, not Botswana. And the only reason those horses in that African desert survive is because local villagers go out and mm-hmm. give them water.
Absolutely. Now,
so that partnership is everywhere.
Now, Wendy, you're a lifelong equestrian, but has writing this book changed your view of horses at all?
Oh, absolutely. As I explain to people, I'm 65, so I was taught to ride in a very traditional manner. I was taught to ride that horses were something like automatons, that you use reward and punishment to work with them, and taught that they had tiny little brains the size of walnuts and were not very intelligent. But, of course, that's not really true. They're quite intelligent, and they're quite sensitive, and if you establish a relationship with the horse, you have a much better situation.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm very interested in, when I'm done with this book, exploring that opportunity more, because I haven't really done that before.
Absolutely. Well, Wendy Williams, thank you for spending some time with us. Thank you for this great book.
Well, thank you for enjoying it. I'm glad you found it worth reading.
Well, people love horses, of course, but it's neat when they get to learn really about, as you said, the epic history of our noble companion. So thanks for what you do.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. My guest has been science writer Wendy Williams, author of the book, The Horse, The Epic History of Our Noble Companion.